Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
There was still a hint of cold hanging in the pre-dawn North Sea air on a spring morning of the year 367, as a gaggle of ships beached themselves in a protected cove on the southeastern shore of Britain. One by one, the occupants hopped out into the cold, knee-deep water, the spray soaking through their trousers, furs, and cloaks. A taste of salt remained on their shaggy beards and mustaches that protected their faces from the cold sea air. The Romans called these men Saxons, and there were hundreds of them pouring off their boats and onto the beach, all of them laden with swords, spears, and axes. They had braved the week-long journey from the poor, sandy coastline of what's now Germany and Denmark for one purpose, and one purpose only: to raid the rich lands of the province of Britain, to sneak between the row of stone-built forts and watchtowers guarding what was by now known as the Saxon shore, to plunder the wealth housed in the rich villas and towns of the coast and interior. These Saxon raiders stayed for weeks, pillaging and plundering their way through a landscape and society that was deeply tied to the rest of the Roman world, as deeply Roman a place as anywhere else on the planet. Their appetites finally sated and their packs full of gold and silver and other precious objects, the Saxons eventually tramped back to their boats for the long sea journey back to the continent. These weren't the first Saxons to come to Britain, and they certainly wouldn't be the last. Over the next two centuries, more and more people would follow them in their hundreds and their thousands from the North Sea coast to Britain. They came to raid, to fight as hired mercenaries for local warlords, to trade, to invade, and eventually to settle. Over these two centuries, these migrants rewrote the political, demographic, cultural, and linguistic maps of Britain. In today's episode, we'll follow the extended history of one family of Saxons from the late 4th to the end of the 6th centuries. By following them, we'll see how one part of Roman Britain became England. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. Migration is a complicated topic in the 21st century, even when we have good data on population flows and the dynamics of movement from place to place and region to region. If studying migration in our day and age is complicated, it's even more so for the 5th and 6th centuries. We don't have census data or ships' manifests. We don't have first-person accounts describing the experience of moving across the North Sea. Nobody sat down and wrote a comprehensive analysis of the topic at the time that it happened. For that matter, we have exactly one written source of any length from Britain in this period, and it's a polemical sermon by a half-mad priest named Gildas. When the migrants arrived, they didn't put up placards saying where they'd come from and when or why. All of this leaves us with a lot of uncertainty about exactly what to make of this Anglo-Saxon migration. Historians and archaeologists have argued about this for literally decades, for whole generations, and even now there isn't a full 100% consensus on how many people moved, when, and exactly from where to where. To understand why even experts who spent their whole professional lives working on this can't come to an agreement, we need to understand what sources we have at our disposal and how we can interpret the evidence that they provide. As I mentioned before, we have very little written evidence. The account of the priest Gildas, written in the 6th century, perhaps 100 years after the migration started in earnest, is our most proximate account in time. I'm going to give you an extended quote from his work, De Excidio Britanniae, on the destruction of Britain, so you can get a sense for the perils of trying to use this as a guide to the migration. Quote, "Then all the counselors, together with that proud tyrant Guthrugern, meaning Vortigern, the British king, were so blinded that, as a protection to their country, they sealed its doom by inviting in among them, like wolves into the sheepfold, the fierce and impious Saxons, a race hateful both to God and to men, to repel the invasions of the northern nations. Nothing was ever so pernicious to our country, nothing was ever so unlucky. What palpable darkness must have enveloped their minds, darkness desperate and cruel. Those very people whom, when absent, they dreaded more than death itself were invited to reside, as one may say, under the selfsame roof. Foolish are the princes, as it is said of Thafneos giving counsel to unwise Pharaoh. A multitude of whelps came forth from the lair of this barbaric lioness, in three kules, as they call them, that is, in three ships of war, with their sails wafted by the wind, and with omens and prophecies favorable, for it was foretold by a certain soothsayer among them that they should occupy the country to which they were sailing 300 years, and half of that time, 150 years, should plunder and despoil the same. Now that's not exactly a think tank's policy analysis on immigration patterns, you know what I mean? Gildas has more to say, and the Anglo-Saxon historian Bede, who wrote some 300 years after these events, built on Gildas's account with additional details and perhaps some other sources, but this is the basic outline of the textual evidence. It's pretty straightforward. A few boatloads of Anglo-Saxons showed up to fight as mercenaries for a British king, they got a taste for what was on offer and sent home for reinforcements, and then the Anglo-Saxons struck out on their own, raiding and fighting their way through Britain. More of them came from their homelands, and they eventually received grants of land. That's basically it as far as written sources are concerned, and we can tell right off the bat that it's either an oversimplification or downright misleading about what actually happened here. What we have in far greater quantity is archaeological material. It's not just that we have more of it in the sense that there have been more and better published digs in the modern era in Britain than anywhere else in the former Roman Empire, but that the material that we do have is better and more thoroughly analyzed and far more accessible than on the continent. It's much easier to get the actual site reports, meaning the excavator's publication of what they found at a dig, from the UK than it is from France, Italy, North Africa, or God forbid Spain, which is the hardest of the former Roman territories to get at. These materials also happen to be in English, which matters when you're trying to read a site report that's heavy on technical terminology in your third, fourth, or fifth language. Trust me on this one, it really does matter. So the sheer quantity of this material can be overwhelming. First and foremost, we have cemeteries. People didn't go into the ground naked. They often brought items with them, from combs to knives to swords to jewelry. By tracking the distributions of those things in space and time, we can learn a lot about patterns of manufacture and what have you. As cutting-edge biological anthropology, forensic science, and the like becomes more integrated with archaeology as a whole, we can learn more and more about the people themselves, including the kinds of stresses their bodies endured, what they ate, where they came from, and what their genes can tell us. Second, we have settlements. Settlements aren't as sexy as cemeteries. I can't believe I just said that. But they tell us even more about the kinds of buildings that people built, how they lived in them, what kinds of animals they kept, what kinds of crops they raised, and so on. I don't think there's any region or period whose historians have done a better job of using archaeological material than those working on post-Roman or Anglo-Saxon Britain. That's mostly because, as we discussed, there really isn't much else to work with. If you want to talk about Britain in the 5th and 6th centuries, you'd better get comfortable with brooches, pottery, swords, cremations, post holes from timber hauls or sunken floored huts, and stable isotope analysis. So, with all of that said, here's what the historians and archaeologists who work on this period all more or less agree on. First, people from the North Sea coast of the continent, between the mouth of the Rhine and the Jutland Peninsula of what's now Denmark, immigrated to Britain. Second, this process of migration began at some point in the first half of the 5th century and continued on well into the 6th century. Third, these migrants brought with them some aspects of their material culture, dress, settlement patterns and buildings, things like that, along with their language or languages. Finally, by the dawn of the 7th century, political units dominated by the descendants of these migrants had come to take over the south and east of England. That's it. Everything else, precisely when, how many, why they left home to travel across the North Sea to an uncertain future, and what they did when they got to Britain, is more or less up for grabs. These aren't minor disagreements, and I'll tell you why. First, when did they begin to arrive? Did these migrants start to show up at the end of the 4th century or halfway through the 5th? In other words, was their migration a cause of the disintegration of Roman Britain, or a symptom of an ongoing collapse of political, economic, and social structures? Second, how many migrants came? Was this a true mass migration of small farmers and common people, or was this a warrior elite coming in and taking over the top ranks of society by displacing the former Romano-British aristocracy? Third, why did they come? Were these migrants fleeing social and political instability in their homeland, or maybe a changing climate that made the North Sea coast less habitable? Or was it the allure of plunder and conquest that brought the Anglo-Saxons to Britain? Finally, were the Anglo-Saxons peaceful settlers who occupied otherwise deserted farmsteads in a depopulated landscape? Or were they vicious warriors who killed or displaced the existing population, driving them to the west of Britain? So let's take this to logical extremes. One historian might say that the Anglo-Saxon migration was carried out in the few decades after 449 or so by a very small group of warriors, maybe 20,000 total in 30 years, who came to plunder and discovered that post-Roman Britain offered a lot of opportunities for ambitious, ruthless men to make their way. These few predatory migrants killed or displaced the Romano-British aristocracy of eastern Britain and set themselves up as petty kings, ruling over a basically unchanged native population. This was effectively the violent replacement of a native elite by a small body of foreign invaders who imposed their culture and language on their new subjects. Now, another historian might say that the Anglo-Saxons started arriving in Britain around the year 400, and that hundreds of thousands of them arrived over the course of a century or more of continuous population movement across the North Sea to Britain. Social and political conditions at home, with an assist from a worsening climate, made it impossible for them to continue their way of life on the continent. While there were some violent clashes between these immigrants and the Romano-British population, most of these migrants established themselves on otherwise deserted land as peaceful farmers. This was a mass migration by common people who came in such great numbers that their language and culture became dominant by dint of weight of population. These are a bit hyperbolic, but they do represent the two potential ends of the spectrum, and both of these hypothetical historians could present real evidence to support their perspectives. The mass migration hypothesis was popular for a long time, and it's coming back into vogue now, thanks mostly to the evidence of genetics that, to be honest, I'm not really sure the historians pointing to it really understand, but after about 30 years where the elite dominance model was more fashionable. So let me put my cards on the table and present you with my model of how I think all this worked. First, I take the long view of when. Remember our anecdote from the beginning of this episode? Raiders from the continent, meaning Saxons, were already familiar with Britain by the middle of the 4th century at the latest. The Romans probably settled Saxons as federate troops along the coast to defend against similar raids around the end of the 4th century. If Gildas's story about a British king, Vortigern, calling in Saxons to serve as mercenaries is true, he was tapping into patterns of movement across the North Sea that had already existed for at least a century. This plays directly into the second question, how many? If we're assuming a long period of connection between Britain and the North Sea coast where the migrants came from, we're already talking about larger numbers than the pure elite dominance model would suggest. Recent genetic evidence points in the direction of substantial gene flow from the continent to eastern England, though, as I mentioned, it's not straightforward to interpret. But, at the end of the day, that level of migration doesn't just happen overnight. Think about Irish immigration to the United States as a parallel example here. The Great Famine between 1845 and 1852 drove enormous numbers of people to the United States, and in popular culture, it's probably what we think of when we consider Irish immigration. Now, as we'd expect when we look at the numbers, the 1840s and the 1850s were by far the decades with the greatest number of migrants, some 780,000 in the 1840s and 915,000 in the 1850s. But there had already been more than 200,000 Irish immigrants to the U.S. in the 1830s, and more than 435,000 would arrive in the 1860s and the 1870s. That's when my great-great-grandpa came to the U.S., not during the famine. There were close to 400,000 in the 1890s and the 1900s, too, which is when my great-grandma came over from Ireland. Even today, there are plenty of recent Irish immigrants in the United States. There's a real lesson here about the dynamics of migration. It's not a one-time, one-off process where a bunch of people arrive someplace from someplace else and then just stay there. Migration is better understood as a multi-directional flow of people that tends to operate over decades or even centuries along established networks of movement. Now, if we looked at the genes of Americans today, we might see a substantial Irish contribution, but that wouldn't tell us exactly when or how those people got to the U.S. Genetics just are not precise enough to answer those questions. I'm not going to get too deep into the technical language of migration theory here, but there are a few key concepts that we need to grasp. The first is push factors versus pull factors. Push factors are reasons for migrants to leave their homes, political instability, climate change, or what have you, while pull factors are the reasons why migrants choose to go to another place. Pull factors might include economic opportunity or pre-existing family or social connections, which enable what specialists call chain migrations, with members of an extended kin group or social group following one another over the course of generations. The second thing we need to bear in mind is something that I just mentioned, that population flows are dynamic and multidirectional. So let's say 10 young men from the same Irish town left home to travel to America in 1875. They land in New York, and five of them stay there. The other five continue to go west. Two of those remaining five stay in Chicago, where they have an uncle and cousins, and the other three fan out across the Great Plains. 10 years later, there are still three living in New York, two were still in Chicago with their relatives, one is dead, one is living in Texas, and three have returned home to Ireland, either having made their fortune or failed to. The point is this: migrations don't stop at the initial point of arrival in the new land, and migrants often return home after making their fortune or, as I said, or failing to. Life cycle migration is one aspect of this. Think about all the international students who flock to elite universities, stay there for four or more years, and then return home. Now, my great-grandma, for example, came from Ireland to Butte, Montana, then went home to County Cork for a couple of years before she finally moved to Portland, Oregon for good. That's pretty dang common in immigrant communities, to get that kind of back-and-forth continuous movement. These are all insights that help to shape our understanding of the questions that we addressed earlier about the Anglo-Saxon migration. When? How many? Why did they leave home? Or why did they come to Britain? And what they did when they got there. When? A long period. How many? I think a lot, over the course of a century and probably more. Not just elite dominance, though migrants still would have represented a minority relative to the existing population. Why did they come? Well, both push and pull factors are at play here. What did they do when they got to Britain? This is where understanding population flows as multidirectional and dynamic helps, because we don't need to slot people into one category of peaceful settler or violent raider. A young Saxon might raid up the Thames River Valley in his youth, serve in a Lord's War Band for a time in eastern Britain, and then return home to the continent for a decade or more before coming back to Britain with his wife and children to settle on a farmstead. Our understanding of the Anglo-Saxon migration needs to have room for more than just armies of conquest, pillaging warriors, or peaceful settlers. When we consider this migration as a centuries-long process of moving people back and forth across the North Sea, with everything that implies for the politics, economies, and cultures of people living on either side of the water, we get something even more meaningful than just a migration. We get the creation of a whole dynamic world centered on the North Sea. The sea wasn't a barrier, but a highway that connected the people living around its edges into something greater than the sum of its parts.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like, every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now that we have a good, solid, theoretical framework in place for understanding population movements, we can get back to the real people here. We started this episode with a group of Saxon raiders arriving on the southeastern shore of Britain in the year 367, and that's where we'll pick up our story once again. We don't know much about the details of this Saxon incursion, aside from the fact that it seems to have coincided with simultaneous raids or invasions by the Picts from what's now Scotland, and the Scoti, confusingly enough, from Ireland. It might have been apocalyptically large or very small, with its numbers blown out of all proportion by hyperbolic reports of death and destruction. What's almost certain is that this wasn't unfamiliar territory for our friend. We'll call him Ayla. We don't know much about Saxon names from this period, but that will do as well as any. Our friend Ayla was a Saxon who came from just inland of the coast in what's now northern Germany, near the mouth of the Elbe River along the North Sea. His family were farmers who lived in a settlement that consisted of around 10 farmsteads, all arranged in a row. Each of these farmsteads was enclosed by a wall, with a central longhouse constructed of wood, surrounded by sunken floored huts that served as storage buildings and workshops and the like, with barns and other structures out back. Ayla's whole extended family lived in this enclosure, where they grew millet and kept animals, including sheep for wool, along with cattle and pigs. Nobody in this little settlement was rich, but they were reasonably prosperous. The border of the Roman Empire wasn't near to Ayla's settlement, but he was still familiar with people and objects that came from it. The local notables carried swords manufactured in the empire, they drank Roman wine, they wore belts with Roman-made buckles, and they ate off of Roman tableware. Trade wasn't their only interaction with Rome, though. They raided, and raided regularly, along the coasts of Gaul and Britain, and occasionally up the major waterways into the interior. This was a substantial source of income for Ayla and the people of his community. They weren't just farmers, but also warriors who supplemented what their farms produced with the spoils of raiding. So when Ayla hopped onto a boat to cross the sea for Britain as a young man in 367, he wasn't heading into uncharted waters. Saxons had already been doing this for a long time, and would continue doing it for a long time afterward. Ayla's father had raided Britain some 20 years before and had told his young son what to expect. Ayla proved to be a successful raider on his first trip, and he decided that he liked raiding and fighting better than he liked farming. This was a time of political upheaval and expanding populations beyond the Roman frontier, and there were opportunities to be had for ambitious young men like Ayla with talent, smarts, and a mean streak. He gathered first a few dozen, and then a few hundred other men around him, and made himself a lethal nuisance on the coasts of Roman territory, sacking villas up the Thames and the Seine, and even reaching as far south as Aquitaine. Success attracted more followers, and soon Ayla built a fine timber hall for himself in the village where he'd grown up, with the proceeds of all his expeditions. Eventually, though, Ayla ran afoul of another Saxon lord. He lost a battle, and the rival lord burned his hall to the ground. What could he do? Well, Ayla still had a few hundred men, and he still had ships. Britain was familiar ground, and the empire was chronically short on soldiers. Ayla had heard from a cousin, who'd raided there recently, that much of the island's garrison had packed up and headed for Gaul with their general, Magnus Maximus. And so, in the year 384, Ayla and his men and their families all headed for Britain, where they struck a deal to serve as federati, allies of the empire, manning some of those stone forts along the southeastern coast that they'd snuck past on their raids so many times before. Ayla proved to be as competent at catching would-be raiders as he'd ever been at raiding. He built a life for himself along the coast of what's now Kent, marrying the daughter of a minor local landowner after his first wife, his Saxon wife, died in childbirth. His son wanted no part of the life of a Roman soldier, though, and when he was old enough, he headed back to the old Saxon lands across the North Sea to make his fortune there as a war leader. So let's skip ahead 20 or so years to the year 410. The last great usurper in the West, Constantine III, had left Britain with the remnants of his army. What was left were federati like Ayla, now an elderly man close to the end of his life, and local Romano-British landowners trying to figure out how they fit into a radically different order, one without a central political force. They were struggling to deal with increased raiding by Saxons, Picts from the north, and Scoti from Ireland. But what solutions were available? The Roman troops weren't coming back. Ayla had an idea. He sent word to his son back in the Saxon homeland, now a seasoned warlord with decades of experience as a soldier and a raider under his belt, with an offer of land and pay in return for defense of the coast. Now, Ayla's son was doing too well at home to take him up on it. Maybe he just didn't care much for his father. But he did send a cousin with a few hundred men who were looking for work, who settled in, and they did a pretty good job of defending the coast themselves for the next couple of decades. Ayla passed on to the next world, and he was buried just like any other local landowner in southeastern England, albeit one with a nice military belt buckle and a sword in his hand. At this point, early in the 5th century, there wasn't an archaeologically distinguishable migrant population that looked any different from the native Romano-British. Like the Visigoths in Aquitaine, any Saxons present at this point were probably relatively few in number, and they lived material lives that were fairly similar to the surrounding population, which makes them difficult or impossible for us to pick out. Unlike the Visigoths, though, these first migrant Saxons, men like Ayla, they represented something very important, an anchor point, what we'd call a pull factor for future migrants who enabled the kind of multi-generation chain migration that I mentioned earlier. One of the most essential things for any immigrant population is an existing support structure, which is usually based on kin and or ethnic identity. That's why migrants tend to cluster in particular areas. It's why my great-grandma went to Butte, Montana, where her brothers worked as copper miners along with hundreds of other Irish immigrants. Ayla's son never made the trip to Britain to live. He was too successful at home, and he preferred raiding to settling down to defend some broken-down forts. But his youngest son, Wulfhere, saw a real opportunity in the ruins of Roman Britain. It was now around the year 440, and Roman Britain was well into its collapse. As we've discussed in a couple of previous episodes, episode 6 on Roman Britain, and then episode 12 on the fall of the Roman economy, the island's once great cities were now mostly deserted. Its many small market towns had disappeared. The money economy was gone, and manufacturing, even of pottery, had disappeared. The population had begun to drop from its peak as well, and the island's inhabitants were letting formerly cultivated land either go fallow or turned it into less intensive pasture for grazing animals instead. We can see these changes really clearly in the villas of eastern Britain in the first few decades of the 5th century. Many of these had once been luxurious buildings with mosaic floors and private bathhouses and private libraries, little pockets of cloistered aristocratic life separated from the actual hard work of running an agricultural estate and everything that it entailed. Now in this period, and here I'm following the interpretation of an archaeologist named James Gerard in a really excellent book called The Ruin of Roman Britain, now a whole bunch of villas changed pretty dramatically. Rooms in the villas were partitioned to make room for more people, presumably the owner's retinue or war band. essential functions like metalworking and grain drying moved from outbuildings into the main house. And if grain drying moved there, so too did things like brewing and the storage of agricultural surpluses. These villas didn't become fortresses like castles, not exactly, but they were now very obviously the centers of power for local strongmen instead of luxury residences for Roman aristocrats. Our new friend Wulfhere's cousin, the Saxon who had come over to work with Aela a few decades before, was one of the players in this increasingly fragmented world around the mouth of the Thames River. Like Aela, this cousin had married into the local aristocracy, and he and his Saxons were part of a local strongman's war band. They allied with and occasionally fought the retainers of other aspiring strongmen. Wulfhere and the few dozen Saxons he'd convinced to sail over with him slid easily into this world, where military service and small-scale fighting earned compensation for warriors who could pick and choose the lords who would reward them. The economy may have gone south, but the local aristocrat-turned-petty warlord that Wulfhere and his men were working for still had coin and treasure with which to pay them for their services. And as long as he was paying, they were happy to do his bidding and fight and raid on his behalf. This was a successful little partnership, a mutually beneficial one. And after a summer of this work, Wulfhere returned home to the continent richer and with a growing reputation as a warrior and a leader. Before he left, the Romano-British aristocrat, seeing the advantages here, asked Wulfhere if he'd bring back more men the next year. The following summer, Wulfhere returned, this time with a few hundred men, in a dozen ships. They made quick work of the local aristocrats' rivals, and this man, he was beginning to call himself a king now dominated a sizable area of Kent and Essex. The next year, Wulfhere returned with still more men, and this time they brought their families with them. This aristocrat gave them some abandoned land just north of the Thames, expanding a small settlement that had previously been occupied by Wulfhere's cousin and his grandfather Aela and his men before them. This site is called Mucking, and it's one of the earliest identifiable Anglo-Saxon settlements in eastern Britain. This wasn't a rich community, at least not in its early phase. And for now, at this point, it consisted of a disorganized cluster of sunken-floored huts dug into the ground amid a barren and pretty unproductive landscape. We get a sense that this was marginal land. These sunken-floored huts were a direct importation from the exact part of the continent that these people had come from. Archaeologists, using a German term, call them Grubenhäuser, and they hadn't appeared anywhere in Britain prior to this point. Like, they were obviously an importation. Now, these humble structures, nothing fancy, literally just dugout huts, they're as sure a sign as any that what we're seeing here are migrants. Mucking was one of the earliest of these settlements, and from there, the migrants spread west from the coast along the major roads and waterways of the interior. Back home on the continent, word of Britain and the potential for raiding, and perhaps more, was beginning to spread. The lands from which men like Aela and then Wulfhere had come were the furthest south, but they were connected to the lands further north by trade and by other kinds of networks, political, social, cultural. What these people called themselves at this point is hard to say. Later writers, namely Bede, would call them Angles and Jutes and would give up a nice little detailed schema of where they lived in the homeland and where they came in Britain. But at this point, they may all have been buried under the label of Saxons, which meant something like knife wielder, and it may have functioned as an umbrella identity in the same way as the term Viking did later. You can hide a multitude of sins under a broad umbrella. Now, in the traditional scheme, the one that Bede has made familiar to everybody, the Angles came from what's now the border between Denmark and Germany, the states of Schleswig and Holstein, while the Jutes came from the Jutland Peninsula of Denmark. At any rate, though, the whole North Sea coast from the mouth of the Rhine to Jutland and Denmark sent migrants to Britain. Materially speaking, these people were all fairly similar, and while we can't know for sure, their languages were probably either mutually intelligible or something close to it. If they hadn't already by this point, ships were setting out from beaches between Jutland and Frisia for opportunities in Britain. So let's come back to our friend Wulfhere. It was now around 450, and he'd been working as effectively a mercenary for this Romano-British aristocrat turned king for about a decade with great success. He'd built a fine timber hall for himself amid the sunken-floored huts at Mucking, just like the ones the lords at home had, and more warriors from the Saxon homelands were joining him every year. Other Romano-British aristocrats turned petty warlords were hiring outside fighters as well. One brought in Scoti from across the Irish Sea. Several had turned to Saxons like Wulfhere, and another hired a war band of Franks from northern Gaul. Some of these Saxon warriors came only for a little while, just to make their fortune, before returning home for good. Others brought their families and stayed permanently. Still others came to Britain for a while, went back home, came back to Britain for another round of raiding and fighting, and then eventually decided to stay in one place or another. We have to imagine, as I mentioned before, a whole spectrum of population movement, not just one-off migration. Wulfhere and his warband found riches and success working for this petty king, but he'd always been an ambitious man, and so too were his followers. Eventually, they started to chafe under the yoke, so Wulfhere did what came naturally. He struck out on his own. By this point, the late Roman political order was dead and gone. Power had devolved fully into the hands of men like this local Romano-British king. Why couldn't Wulfhere, who'd spent a decade there and had family ties in this part of Britain going back 70 years, why couldn't he set himself up as a power in his own right? This is more or less what Bede and Gildas tell us. After working as mercenaries for local strongmen, the Saxons eventually set out on their own. This is essentially the story of the second half of the 5th century, one of a power struggle in eastern Britain between the indigenous warlords and foreign-born imports like Wulfhere. We have to imagine this as a fluid environment, one where petty warlords of various stripes stung each other with raids, fought each other in pitched battles, and then struck alliances and agreements with each other, many of them cemented with marriages. Migrants from the continent poured in. According to a deep analysis of southeastern Britain in this period by archaeologists Sue Harrington and Martin Welsh, they spread out along the Roman roads and major rivers, dominating transport routes and picking out the most strategically important places to establish settlements. It's to this period that the legend of King Arthur belongs, based on Gildas's account of clashes between Romano-British warlords and invading Saxons. This is clearly too neat and tidy a division. Some of the indigenous aristocrats must have allied with the newcomers, while some indigenous aristocrats probably used Saxon warriors within their retinues of armed retainers. We can see this fluidity and complexity in the burials of people from this half century, where there was a mixture of cremation and inhumation and a great diversity of artifacts. Brand new styles of jewelry and metalwork pioneered in Jutland and northern Germany simultaneously appeared in graves in eastern Britain, while late Roman military fashions of belts, things the post-Roman native aristocracy had loved even before the Saxons arrived, became common as well. Burials with weapons appeared in large numbers. Strongmen were trying to make their power felt, and they had a diverse vocabulary of items with which to do that, some of which pointed in the direction of the continent, and others of which were variations on long-standing themes already present in this part of Britain. This was a shifting and violent world where those with skill at arms, political savvy, and a sense for when to fight and when to make alliances would have been essential. It was a far more local world than Roman Britain had been, with small communities bound together by kinship and their ties to one of those petty lords of Romano-British or Saxon descent that we've been discussing. Nothing was set in stone, both literally, nobody was building in stone, and figuratively.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
By 500 or 525 at the latest, this state of affairs had more or less settled down in Eastern Britain. A new order emerged. There was less variation to burial rites, to name just one thing. Cremation disappeared, and inhumation became the dominant form of burial. It was far more common for men to be buried with items of war gear like weapons, shields, and belt buckles, while women took with them into the grave complex assemblages of jewelry and personal adornment, things like brooches and wrist clasps, all of which varied distinctly from region to region as a sign of identity. Settlements were larger and wealthier, with more timber hulls among the sunken-floored huts that were already common. It's absolutely remarkable how quickly continental fashions became dominant throughout this whole region, essentially the entire east and south of Britain, what we'd call Essex, Sussex, Wessex, Somerset, East Anglia, the Isle of Wight, Kent, and Northumbria. This is the root of the discussion that we had at the beginning of this episode about models of what this migration looked like, because that rapid dominance is what these various models and theories have to try to explain. How and why did these continental fashions spread so quickly, and what relationship did those practices have to the people who used them? So let's take a quick step back here to our friend Wulfhere around 450, when he threw off the weight of the Romano-British petty king he'd been working for and set out on his own. Over the next couple of decades, Wulfhere and his compatriots, the other similar warlords and their warbands freshly arrived from the continent, had their successes and their failures. They won battles and lost them, struck alliances and betrayed them, conquered land and lost it. The Romano-British warlords and aristocrats lost, then rebounded, then lost again. Finally, the two groups, and even that term, two groups, is probably an oversimplification of a complex landscape, they melded into one. I really doubt that the newcomers from the continent simply killed all the Romano-British warlords and aristocrats or reduced them to poverty. The most likely explanation involves fighting that eventually settled into a mixed group that more or less adopted a common material culture based on a lot of fashions imported from the continent, the kinds of things that we've talked about. Wulfhere wouldn't have lived to see these developments play out, and neither would his son. His grandson, though, we'll call him Eirik, would have been among the first generation of new warlords to be born into and shaped by this new world. And what kind of world was it? Well, first of all, it was a mixed world. Whatever happened to the Romano-British aristocracy, the newcomers didn't kill or drive off all the current inhabitants of this territory. Eastern Britain wasn't a desolate wasteland when they arrived, though it had been a bit depopulated, and it didn't become one afterward. Settlements of Germanic-speaking newcomers would have lived in relatively close proximity to Latin or more likely British speakers, and all would have been subject to the same lords, this new mixed aristocracy. Processes of acculturation were already underway, and members of those native communities were intermarrying with the newcomers and adopting their language and their material culture. We don't have to view this as violent conquest or the brutal imposition of foreign practices, though there may have been some of that, but as something more like peer pressure worked out on a large societal scale. As I said earlier, I do think that there was some large-scale migration going on here. Some of these newcomers were youngish, male warriors filling out the war bands of ambitious strongmen like Volferra, who surely recruited from the fertile grounds along the North Sea coast that had been providing skilled troops and raiders for decades by this point. Some of them probably brought their families with them, and others married native women. Others probably came as pure settlers, filling in some of these lords' newly conquered lands that had been depopulated as Roman Britain fell to pieces and the population fell. So why did they come? Well, we have pull factors, opportunity and the anchor points offered by existing kin and ethnic networks. But there were also push factors, including the possibility, not the certainty, of worsening climate that made the sandy, marginal land along the coast of the North Sea less viable for farming activities. But again, by the first quarter of the 6th century, this new world in eastern Britain was settling in. We still know next to nothing about what was going on from written sources, but there are enough hints from later that we can start to read backwards to build some sort of understanding of the political scene. The petty warlords of Wulfhere's generation were starting to solidify into something more like institutionalized power and authority, maybe even kings, by the time of his grandson Eirik. The lands over which they ruled may have been entirely new creations, or they may have borne some relationship to pre-existing Roman territorial systems based on civitates, on urban centers that, to be frank, no longer really existed at this point. The in-depth survey of the archaeologists that I mentioned earlier suggests that the new settlements grew up in the best and most strategic spots first, perhaps founded by these newly powerful warlords, and then filled in the more marginal territory afterward. So what makes us think this world was settling in? Well, one of the biggest indicators is increasing wealth in the grave goods that we find from this period, which points to increasing social stratification. In other words, the rich were getting richer, and if they were getting richer, they were probably getting more powerful. It's easy for us to imagine our new friend Eirik inheriting territory first carved out by his grandfather Wulfhere, and then consolidated by his father, with more and more prosperous settlements growing up as new immigrants arrived and settled in. This meant that there was more surplus for a still violent and predatory elite to take in. The lands these richer and more powerful elites controlled still weren't all that large. As with everything in this time, it's hard to say for sure, but a later list of kingdoms and territories called the Tribal Hidage offers some clues, albeit from the late 7th or 8th century, that probably preserves some earlier information. This interesting document was probably compiled by an overlord who assessed the later Anglo-Saxon kingdoms in hides, a unit of land measurement, presumably to calculate how much tax or tribute they owed. On this list, we see large kingdoms that definitely didn't exist in the 6th century, but also a patchwork of small ones with names like East Vixna, Elmedsatna, Hika, Farpinga, and Spalda, only some of which we can actually locate on a map now. There must have been dozens of these small territories in southern and eastern Britain, and our friend Eirik had one of them to himself. This wasn't an isolated world. Especially in Kent, just to the south of the mouth of the Thames River, there were strong, really strong, connections with the Frankish world in Gaul. The nature of these connections is hard to suss out exactly. There may have been some sort of formal political relationship between the Merovingian Frankish kingdoms and the rulers of Kent, though that seems less likely to me than informal political connections and simply large amounts of trade across the English Channel. If the North Sea wasn't a barrier but a highway, we should think of the Channel the same way. The most common Frankish items that we see in the material record are gold braid, helmets, distinctive axe heads, and shield bosses. These are exactly the kinds of items that an Anglo-Saxon warrior elite would want to import from opportunistic Frankish traders, or that opportunistic Anglo-Saxon traders would want to purchase from the Franks to sell to the lords of their lands. These were simultaneously luxury items that showed off our new petty rulers' power and prestige, and at the same time, useful tools of violence. We shouldn't rule out Franks as part of the continental migrants to Britain during this period or the earlier period. After all, they were right next to the Saxons along the North Sea coast, and there's some reason to think that the Jutes, who showed up in Britain, might have traveled there via the Frankish lands at the mouth of the Rhine. So as our friend Euric came to maturity as a ruler of this small, petty kingdom, living in a fancy, post-built wooden hall with his personal war band of followers to whom he dispensed treasure and fancy imported Frankish axes and helmets and gold braid for their wives, he must have noticed that some of these petty kingdoms were absorbing the others. The story of the second half of the 6th century is the process of consolidation of small territories into larger political units, the roots of the great Heptarchy, the seven kingdoms of Anglo-Saxon England. This wasn't a straightforward process, and since we don't have anything in the way of written sources to go on, we don't have much idea of how it went down. There was presumably consolidation through inheritance or marriage alliances, and of course, there was armed conquest. Eastern Britain of the 5th and 6th centuries was a violent place, and there's no sense in pretending that it wasn't. Whether we think the Anglo-Saxon migration and the world it created was one based on violent takeover or not, there's no denying that this patchwork of small kingdoms and the processes that made it so wasn't a violent one. A large-scale comparison of burials from all across Britain between the years 250 and 700 makes this really clear. Of the more than 3,000 skeletons from 5th to 7th century Eastern Britain, exactly what we've been talking about in today's episode, more than 40 of them showed evidence of trauma from edged weapons, about 1.3% of the total. That's 4 times the rate of identifiable trauma in late Roman Britain, and 6 times as many as in contemporary Eastern Britain. Now that doesn't include blunt force trauma, or trauma from edged weapons that didn't happen to catch bone on its way through soft tissue, and not all the skeletons were well preserved enough to allow for identification of this kind of injury. The true rate of death by violent injury is probably much, much higher. So this was the world that Ella, Wulfhere, and Euric lived in and shaped, one of endemic violence but also cultural dynamism driven by large numbers of immigrants and their interactions with the existing population. This was a new world, one radically different than what had existed in late Roman Britain 200 years before, and one that had parted company with the immediately post-Roman Britain in the first half of the 5th century. Whether they were many, comparatively speaking, as I've argued, or comparatively few, matters less at the end of the day than the fact that they rewrote the entire social, political, cultural, economic, and linguistic map of the region. It wasn't a simple or a straightforward process, but one of back and forth movement across the North Sea that served as a highway, bringing people and practices from place to place. That's how this part of Britain became England. It turned away from the Mediterranean and what remained of the Roman world at this point, and toward a brand new world centered on the North Sea, one that would eventually bring the Vikings, the Normans, and 1,000 years later, a long way down the road, the beginnings of the capitalist economy that defines our modern world. That, though, is a story for another time, another day. In the next fall of Rome, we'll discuss the successor kingdoms as a whole. We're going to do some comparative analysis of the various ways in which they built on or destroyed the foundation that the Roman Empire had left behind. From North Africa to Hadrian's Wall, there was a new world coming into being, a medieval world, and that's what we're going to explore. Thank you very much for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. And if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA for all the latest updates. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, you can always drop me a line. If you want to help me out even a bit more, I'd really appreciate it if you took the survey at wondery.com/survey, wondery.com/survey. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.